Got it.
All right, I will call this hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is April 4th, 2024. A quorum is present. We do have Representative Curran participating remotely today. The first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Johnson?
Chair Becker, again, I've reviewed the minutes and I make a motion to approve.
All right, any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Moving right along, we've got Representative Brand here. I will move to re-refer House File 3499 back to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Brand. Please tell us about your bill. And as you know, you're here only because of a couple provisions that relate to the jurisdiction of this committee. But please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I want to start by setting the tone for this bill as both public safety and worker safety. As we discuss the merits of the bill, consider that public safety and worker safety apply to not just our individual districts, but rather across the entire state. In 2023, train derailments increased by 13.5%. That means we're headed in the wrong direction. So in the years since Joel Mueller first stepped into his first locomotive, trains have only gotten longer. 15,000 feet of train is quite a lot of product, but also a lot of potential for wrong to occur. In my district, trains are so long they've actually blocked portions of highway from the train yard back across several intersections. This could sever the link between EMS and a patient in trouble, or in some cases, a larger than normal derailment near Raymond, Minnesota that occurred last year. According to a November 2023 WCCO report, months after the derailment, the soil and groundwater in the area are still contaminated with benzene, a known cancer-causing chemical. Also included in this bill is an update to the 2010 statute covering $5 million from $1 million in insurance coverage in case a private company tasked with driving deadheaded locomotive engineers and trainmen to the next train or to pick them up after their day of service is done. Just remember that things cost a lot more than they did in 2010, as evidenced in grocery store prices. Costs associated with the crash could also include lost wages, lost ability to earn wages, medical bills, and worse. And of course, all of those costs have also gone up since 2010. Nick, who is also here, will come and testify in this bill as well, can articulate exactly why acting now is in the best interests of the workers. We are here to discuss the civil penalties of this legislation. However, no doubt big corporations that own these rail lines will say that we have no authority to regulate such issues. They will say that federal law preempts what we can do as a state. They will quote an old law from 1945 in Arizona. However, I'm more interested in the 1970 law passed by Congress. I wish to also pass up the signed affidavit from Lawrence Mann, the author of the legislation in 1970, stating that indeed states have the right to read from a state may adopt or continue enforce an additional or more stringent law, regulation, or order related to rail safety or security when the law, regulation, or order is necessary to eliminate or reduce an essential local safety or security risk. It is not incompatible with law, regulation, or order of the U.S. government, and does not unreasonably burden interstate commerce. Can I have you hand these out to the members of the committee? CPKC also testified that in previous committees, they are running 7,500 feet of train already in most cases. So I'd like to turn it over to my two testifiers that I have here, Nick Kadish and Joel Mueller, to talk a little bit more about this legislation, and I'll stand for questions after.
All right, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name is Mark Triola, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Koenigs, Leneve & Kvass in Wayzata, Minnesota. Our firm has been representing injured railroad workers for decades now, and I'm here today to address the preemption arguments raised by the lobbyists for the railroad companies and to stress the importance of increasing the underinsured and uninsured coverage for railroad motor carriers. To the first topic, this legislation is not preempted under the Federal Railroad Safety Act. The discussion of preemption of state railroad legislation must begin with the Supreme Court's 1993 decision in CSX versus Easterwood. In that case, the court interpreted the preemption provisions of the FRSA and held that the subject matter is not preempted when the Secretary has issued regulations that merely touch upon or relate to that subject matter. Further, the Supreme Court has specifically recognized a state's interest and right to regulate railroad safety, noting that the term covering written within the provision displays significant consideration for a state law in that its expressed preemption provision is both prefaced by and succeeded by expressed savings clauses. So what does that mean? That the Supreme Court's substantially subsumes language is interpreted to mean that the federal regulation does not specifically address the subject matter, then the subject matter of the challenge law is not preempted. Here, and in light of the express savings clauses in the FRSA, FRSA preemption is even more disfavored than federal preemption generally. Here, there's no dispute that neither the FRA nor Congress have weighed in on the issue of train length, and therefore this law is not preempted. And I know the Southern Pacific versus Arizona case has been mentioned here. That bill is not controlling law. That bill was that case was from 1940, 1946, I believe, based on a 1912 Arizona law. The law passed when Arizona first became a state. The law was passed under the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is prior to the current regulatory apparatus here. So the Southern Pacific Railroad does not apply. And really quickly to the second topic, the issue of increasing UIM and UM coverage for railroad motor carriers is a problem that the railroads created when they decided to outsource the transportation of employees to third parties. Workers and their families should not lose vital protection simply because their employer decided to transfer its obligations to a different company. This bill is needed to rectify that and fill in the gaps that have been created to third-party outsourcing that skirt worker protections. And with that, I support this bill and I'm willing to address any questions you may have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I didn't have anyone else signed up to testify.
We're good.
Okay, great. We did have a couple of public testifiers signed up. So first up, I have Amber Backus and then Andy Davis on deck. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus with United Strategies, and I'm also the Executive Director of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. While we have numerous policy concerns about the bill, including adverse impacts on safety, commerce, emissions, and passenger rail capacity, we understand your purview is limited to the civil penalties and interaction with federal law. I know you've heard the railroads repeatedly speak to laws like what's being proposed in House File 3499 as being federally preempted. And in this case, there is U.S. Supreme Court precedent for federal preemption that is specific to train length, which Mr. Davis will speak to. But I'd like to share some insights from the Federal Railroad Administration, who on Wednesday of this week published its federal two-person crew rule, which repeatedly recognized the need for national uniform standards when regulating railroads. Within the commentary on the rule, the FRA remarked that, one, in issuing this final rule, the FRA will ensure that laws, regulations, and orders related to railroad safety are nationally uniform by preventing varying state laws regulating crew size from creating a patchwork of potentially inconsistent rules governing train operations across the country. The lack of a uniform standard would likely result in additional costs and operational efficiencies. Later on, they said, this final rule meets Congress's mandates that the laws, regulations, and orders related to railroad safety be nationally uniform. And they also addressed its exception to preemption by saying the rule clarifies that FRA's statutory preemption provision does include a narrow exception to FRA's broad authority to preempt state laws. But this narrow exception allows non-federal regulation of essentially local safety hazards, and that state laws do not, in FRA's view, address an essentially local hazard because they would apply statewide. The Railroad Association's position on preemption aligns very much with the Biden administration's, and we'd ask that you vote against a bill that disrupts the industry's operation and invites time-consuming and costly litigation for both railroads and the state. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Andy Davis. And then I don't have anyone else signed up ahead of time. If there are any other members of the public wishing to testify, now would be your time. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Andy Davis, and I'm a partner at the Stinson firm in Minneapolis. I've represented Class 1 railroads in Minnesota since I began practicing at the firm more than 15 years ago, including numerous cases involving federal preemption. Nearly 80 years ago, in a case called Southern Pacific Company versus Arizona, the U.S. Supreme Court held that an Arizona law that limited train length violated the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. The law was unconstitutional because it gave states the ability to control interstate commerce far beyond their own borders by requiring rail carriers to reassemble trains on a state-by-state basis or conform to the most restrictive state law. And as an aside, Southern Pacific was one of the first cases we read in our constitutional law class at the University of Minnesota Law School more than 20 years ago. HF 3499 is very similar to the Arizona law. If the bill were passed, a railroad would be forced to run all trains to meet the most restrictive state standards or break up and reassemble its trains at every border. This would impose a serious burden on interstate commerce and undermine uniformity in regulation. The Supreme Court clearly forbid this in 1945, and Southern Pacific remains good law today. This bill would also be federally preempted under the ICC Termination Act, or ICTA, passed in 1995 by Congress. That law largely eliminated state regulation over rail operations in the interest of federal uniformity. The statute gives the STB exclusive jurisdiction over and expressly preempts state efforts to regulate rail transportation. And transportation is defined in federal law very broadly to include the movement of passengers or property by rail. Without question, this bill does come within the scope of the STB's exclusive jurisdiction and would be preempted if challenged in court. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Brand, for your bill. I just have a quick question. I'm probably not the only person who saw the piece in the Reformer yesterday about fines that are not. So, I mean, I guess my first question is, why are these civil penalties so low? They seem extremely low to me.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Finke. What I would say is this. Last year, we had the opportunity to talk about two-person crews in Minnesota, and we passed that law. Now, that law became law of the land, and the penalties are somewhat different than they were when we passed that legislation last year. The penalties that we have in this bill are very similar to what we passed last year with two-person crews. We chose a civil penalty as a way to at least give this some teeth, so that way, when something does occur, there can be some action taken to enforce the legislation that we're trying to pass. So, it could potentially be higher, but we wanted to kind of keep it similar.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Finke.
Just quickly, thank you, Chair Becker Finn. So after reading that report in the paper and the apparent refusal of corporations that are making record profits to pay their fines, mm-hmm. It feels very strange to me that we would consider a $200 fine a meaningful fine. So I appreciate you bringing this, and I want to make sure that we're protecting our workers and keeping these corporations responsible.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to put on the record, if I might, Madam Chair, I know that the motion is to send this back to transportation. Mm-hmm. Since there are, you know, some pretty significant insurance implications here, I think that the bill should take a visit to the Commerce Committee. I don't know. Representative Brand, do you know, is there a plan to do that?
Representative Brand.
Right now, there's no plan to do that. That was something that was brought up in the Transportation Committee as well. And for the life of me, I can't remember why we... Go ahead.
The Commerce Chair waived hearing it.
That's what. Yep.
All right.
Representative Scott.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Brand, there's quite a significant jump in the amount of insurance you're requiring these railroads to carry, like fivefold, right?
Correct.
And so I think comparing that to grocery prices is not a fair comparison. I understand Bidenflation has got us all, you know, with less money in our pocket, but why this large increase in liability that seems not commensurate with what you're trying to do here? If you could start by answering that question.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. What I would say is that it's more than just inflation. We're talking about a lot of different things. We're talking about the person's ability to make income. We're talking about medical payments. We're talking about a lot of these things, and they've gone up as well. And so if you have a crew of three and they get hurt, somebody dies, there's a lot of costs associated with that. We want to make sure that the people that are in those locomotives driving the products we have across America, we want to make sure that they're held honest to what the cost is to that sort of thing. And so that way we're not making sure that there's additional bills that they have to cover because that, you know, PTI or whichever organization is driving these folks around don't have the appropriate amount of coverage. And I have somebody here that can also testify on that, specifically Nick from the Smart Union.
Not sure if we'll need that. Representative Scott, follow up.
I'm just really curious why this amount is so large. And what I've heard, and I don't know if this is accurate, perhaps Ms. Bacchus could inform us, is $5 million even something that there's an insurance product for right now in this space? Do you know, Representative Brand?
And Representative Scott, if you could point to which of the numbers you're referring to in the bill, that would be helpful.
Right. Doesn't this take the liability pieces to, aren't they going from $1 million to $5 million? Or is that taken out of the bill?
I mean, 3.2.
Okay, well, that is not before us. The issue that's before us is the Judiciary Committee is the civil action, and you could speak to the increases in penalties on the civil action. But that's the reason I said this needed to be heard in my committee. That's what's before us.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you're kind of making my case that this needs to go to Commerce. This should not have been waived by the committee chair. This is a significant increase. And if there's no insurance product out there, by all means, it needs to go to Commerce to have that hashed out. I guess that concludes my questions then, Madam Chair, since we aren't taking that up.
All right. Seeing no, Representative Niska. Sorry, I usually let Representative Scott go last.
Yeah, sorry, I wasn't quick enough on raising my hand.
I was surprised when someone talked about a Supreme Court case and you weren't first on the list. So, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, and maybe Mr. Triola wants to address, I think there are some, it seems like there are two pretty tough federal statutory interpretation problems, actually, with the argument you would need to, or the state would need to advance to uphold this bill, and the language is in Mr. Mann's affidavit, and I think it's 49 U.S.C. 2601 or 2106A, referring to both. It needs to be necessary to eliminate or reduce an essentially local safety or security hazard, and does not unreasonably burden interstate commerce. I think that there's pretty serious trouble with this bill on both of those requirements to fit within the federal statute that you're relying on. And so I'm curious whether you can address, and a couple of testifiers raised this point, that a statewide rule, that seems hard to square with the idea of it being essentially local, and also the necessity to, I guess, take a longer train and repackage it into shorter trains when you get to the Minnesota border. Seems like it's going to be a pretty hard, heavy lift to say that doesn't unreasonably burden interstate commerce. So I was wondering if one of you wanted to address those concerns.
Sure, I can address
Mr. Triola.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the A2C local ordinance. The purpose of Lawrence Mann's affidavit is specifically to address towns, communities, counties addressing safety ordinances, say like a noise regulation. You can't run trains in here from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. or whatever it may be, which would create a weird patchwork of those types of regulations through an estate, where the safety organizations statewide, which have been upheld in numerous court cases throughout this country, states are able to create those types of regulations, whether it's in Pennsylvania and they required toilets in their trains or headlights on their trains or whatever it may be. States can create those ordinances and those safety products to ensure the safety of the communities within their state, not so much local ordinances within the state itself, if that makes sense. Sir.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that addressed, I think, that gets at one of them. And I'm not as familiar with the case law, obviously, as you are, as it relates to, you know, a statewide rule. The other issue, though, I think, and I think it's fairly reasonable to or logical to think about, if Minnesota is the only state in the country and we have trains running through our state that have this train length rule, I think that the railroads have a fairly decent argument that if I have to stop in Fargo and repackage my train, or I have to stop in Hudson and repackage my train, I'm not sure where the train tracks are over there, but you understand the point. That seems like and I'm sympathetic to the rail safety issues that we're talking about. I had a great meeting with Mr. Mueller yesterday. I'd love to see more of the data, I think the railroads have a pretty decent argument that that's unreasonably burdening interstate commerce, especially in light of how the Supreme Court has dealt with the train length issue in the past, even if the statutory framework has changed since then.
Representative Niska, it didn't sound like there was a question there.
I guess this was a continuation of my earlier question, which I don't think that Mr. Triola addressed that concern.
Okay,
about.
Got it. I just didn't want a back and forth of you two waxing poetic on railroad law. So, Mr. Triola, to the underlying question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, specifically to your point on train lengths and repackaging, the current Supreme Court case law is states can regulate safety law and safety issues here. The question then becomes whether that law unduly burdens a railroad's practice. So it is sort of a burden shifting here, where a state just has to prove that it is enacting a normal safety law that's in the interest of its community, which then goes to show that the railroad must show that it is not burdened at all, but unduly burdened in its practice. So there have been numerous case laws where, you know, what is unduly burdened becomes a question of fact. The reliance on Southern Pacific Railroad, again, from it's a law was in 1912 that limited trains to, I think it was 17 passenger cars and 70 freight cars, much shorter length in the, you know, 1912 to 1940s. The case that itself that they're relying on was also part of a World War II effort where the federal government was deregulating the railroad industry to try and help and spur the war effort. And so the factual inquiry into that case was case specific, relied on what was going on in Utah, Nevada, and Arizona at the time, where cars have now gotten much, much longer in terms of regulating, you know, 2,000 feet to, you know, now we're over, you know, 1,500 in some cases. So it does become what is unduly burdened and a question of fact. So, you know, what is unduly burdened would be a litigated issue. But it is just on the railroad to show what that burden is.
All right. Representative Niska, final question, and we've got the rest of the agenda to get to.
Yep. Just a final comment, Madam Chair. I won't wax poetic like you worry about.
Very exciting content here this morning.
I wish that the feds would deal with this issue. That's my, you know, bottom line. Representative Finke, I appreciate the point that that, you know, we tried to regulate in this area last year, and the railroads told us that they didn't think it was legal for us to do it, what we did, the state of Minnesota did. And so I don't want us to just, you know, dive back into that same fray when we're trying to deal with something that I think the railroads probably will win that lawsuit about the fee that happened last year. And I'm worried they'll win the lawsuit here too, if the state of Minnesota tries to do something that is really the federal government's job to do. So I hope the federal government will deal with the train length issue, because I do think there's some legitimate safety concerns around this issue that I hope get sorted out. So thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Brand.
Thank you very much for your opportunity to listen to this bill and to hopefully support passage back to the Transportation Committee. What I would say is this. Last year, we were in the same room, and we were talking about two-person crews. There were arguments about litigation. There were arguments about preemption. At the end of the day, it became law in the state of Minnesota. Just on Wednesday, it became law of the land in the national level. And so we do have the authority to do things like that, as proven by last year's opportunity to make worker safety and public safety a really important part of what we did at the legislature last year. And I'm looking forward to this and other opportunities to make rail safety more important and worker safety also more important this year.
All right. With that, I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3499 to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Brand. Thank you. Next up, Representative Pinto. Chair Pinto, I will move to recommend that House File 4537 be placed on the General Register. I understand you have the A4 amendment. Would you like me to go ahead and move that amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, I will move the A4 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. Representative Pinto, to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thanks, members. So House File 4537 is a bill from the Department of Human Services, the Office of Inspector General. It's the policy bill from that agency and that portion of that agency. It's the portion that came out of my committee, and then the A4 amendment, which you just adopted, thank you so much, contains some provisions from Chair Fisher's committee, so kind of using this as a chance to move that along. I believe that the portion that is in this committee's jurisdiction is lines 8.20 to 9.7 of the underlying of the 4537. I guess I assume that all the provisions of the A4 are within this committee's jurisdiction, if that's why we amended that on. And so that provision, Madam Chair, addresses the reporting of when there is suspected fraudulent activity in a program that's overseen by the Office of Inspector General, and simply providing that the name of the reporter, the person who's expressing the concern, is kept confidential. We obviously want to encourage that there would be reports if there's belief that there's some kind of program integrity concerns. And that is the bill. I believe there's somebody here from DHS to answer questions if there are any, and no testifiers. Thank you, Chair.
All right. We didn't have anyone sign up ahead of time. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, I'm curious on the certification holders and the records that are kept on those folks. Is the person's, if we have Apple Tree childcare, but it's owned by John Smith, will the public be able to find out that John Smith is the owner of Apple Tree Childcare?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe Representative Scott could point me to where, I don't know if that's a question sort of broader than the bill or if it's something particular in the bill. I don't know if it's in the section of this committee's jurisdiction. I'm just trying to understand the question, I guess.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Under certification holders on 1.16.
Of the amendment.
Yes, of the A4. Oh. Yes. Thank you.
Oh.
Go ahead, Representative Scott.
I think.
Oh.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So, Representative Scott, those provisions came out of Chair Fisher's committee, so we probably do need to call. It did not come out of my committee, and so we probably will need to call on the department to answer your question.
All right. Come on up. All right. Please introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Larry Hodge, manager of the Office of Inspector General Policy Team. Representative Scott, the provision under what you referenced on line 1.16 of the amendment adds certification holders to the public data component for that mirrors license holders. So controlling individuals, authorized agents, all that information for a license or a certification holder is public. This specific section, though, what we're proposing here is to include email addresses as public data. Email addresses are kind of like the new form of a phone number. All license holders and certification holders have to have a phone number available. We're just adding email addresses to that public data component.
Representative Scott.
Thank you for that answer. That helps clarify that in my mind. Madam Chair, I have another question, if that's all right.
Yep, go ahead, Representative
sure.
Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So why the discrepancy for these exempt DHS licensing, help me understand how it was decided which child care facilities would be exempt and which wouldn't be. It seems like maybe the ones that are located at public schools are exempt, others are not. I'm just trying to get into the mind of how that decision was made.
Mr. Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. In 245A, there's a slew of exemptions for licensure. I don't have the exact reference in 245A. And some of those exemptions are like YMCAs or school-based after-school programs. The license-exempt certified centers component in 245H allows license-exempt centers to become certified, and primarily they choose to opt for certification so they can receive CCAP payments.
Representative Scott.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just, I guess, Representative Scott's questions are, is a good chance just to remind everybody that we made significant changes several years ago and then continuing over the following several years relating to program integrity over a number of these programs. And so this is kind of like, I was reminded by Mr. Hosh, you know, adding the email address, that's sort of like a finishing touch of some tremendous changes made. So appreciate the support and thank you, Chair.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House Bill 4537 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bonner. All right, Representative Bonner, I will move to re-refer House File 4728 to the Taxes Committee, and then I will also move the DE3 amendment in front of us. Do you want to speak to the underlying bill before we get to the amendment?
Actually, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I think it would probably be best to adopt the amendments first and then speak to the thing in its entirety before we vote.
Great. So I understand the other amendment is Representative Scott's amendment. Representative Scott, would you like to move the A1 amendment and speak to it, please?
Certainly, Chair Beckerfin. Thanks for the elevator conversation this morning on the way up to our offices on this amendment. One of the things that I think is a good practice, rather than having sort of broad data language that says to the extent necessary to administer the refund program in this case, is to delineate which data sets or, as you said, fields. It's, you know, I don't swim in the same pond as you, but to make sure that we delineate which parts of data, what kind of data is going to be shared, and delineate that so that there's it's as tight as possible, I guess. I think it's just a good practice to do for our government agencies. So with that, I would encourage member support.
All right. Representative Bonner to the amendment, the A1 amendment.
Thank you for that. As a technologist and agilist for over 30 years, I certainly appreciate good data management practices. And this certainly follows along the guidelines of the minimum data necessary, which is a really important and key element. So I think it actually improves the bill, and I would be delighted to accept it.
All right. With that, Representative Scott moves the A1 amendment to the DE3. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now we're going to vote on the DE3 as amended. So I will renew my motion to adopt the DE3 amendment as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. The bill is now in the shape that you would like. Representative Bonner, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you know, Minnesotans have deep roots and a tradition of participation in the democratic process. We value a longstanding tradition of grassroots support in our politics. Last year, we made historic changes and reduced the influence of big money interests and corporations in our political process in favor of small donors placing their money where their values lie. A big part of this tradition is the Political Contribution Refund Program, which allows every eligible Minnesota citizen to contribute to a political party unit or political candidate of their choice. We make asserting these values easy and affordable and allow individuals to contribute any amount up to $75 or $100 per couple. This state works in concert with the Campaign Finance Board and the Minnesota Department of Revenue to make these refunds available to all citizens. To date, the program has been wildly successful. Today, this process is highly manual, as you know, and almost exclusively conducted via paper. With this bill, we seek to modernize the PCR process, bring it online, making it easy and faster, streamlining the process into an electronic format to meet Minnesotans where they are in the digital age, where convenience and accessibility are not only desired, but expected. This uses the CFB's newly enhanced reporting systems to generate electronic receipts with unique identifiers for each transaction. Party units or candidates can either furnish the link to the Department of Revenue website and that unique identifier to go ahead and process it automatically online through the online form, or they can use the old-fashioned method and simply send a paper receipt with a nice thank you note. As an this bonus, we did adopt the A3 and the D3 today, so that includes bringing paper back into the equation for both receipts and processing claim forms for our less tech-savvy contributors to be able to participate, and also adding the Good Data Management Practices Act back in. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I want to mention that this bill does enjoy bipartisan support in both chambers, and I would ask that you support House File 4728 to bring the Minnesota PCR program into the modern era. And specifically, I will call out that the sections of statute that we are here to discuss today are Sections 1, Subdivision 11B, the data privacy related to the electronic reporting system, and Section 2, Subdivision 4F, the data classification and refund receipt programs. And again, for the first section, we will note that that was amended in the A1. Thank you.
All right. I didn't have anyone signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Representative Boehner, Chair Becker Finn, I actually was going through this bill this weekend, and I had a couple different CPAs look at it that do campaign finance fund, and they did have some concerns on it. And the concern was the lack of an audit trail to make sure that the data is being protected. If it leaks out, there's a lot of people out there that don't want people to know that they donate. And that's why they stay under that threshold where it has to be, it's available to the public. They're concerned that without a audit trail, with the things going in there, that it could possibly, information could possibly be leaked, and they're concerned about that.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. We do have members here from the Minnesota Department of Revenue and the CFB, if either of them would care to come down and speak to their process.
Only if they know the answer. You don't need to come up here if you don't know the answer. Okay. All right, please introduce yourself for the committee and then proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jeff Sigurdson with the Campaign Finance Board. I wonder if the answer is on line 2.25. receipt validation report is basically an audit report of the contributions that qualify for a PCR refund that's being sent to the Department of Revenue, but it remains private data. It's not available in terms of inspecting the information on the contributions being made by, by any individual.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn's the testifier. The concern is if somebody gets in and starts disseminating the information, who's getting in looking at the information? That's what an audit trail does, so we know who's actually looking at it.
Mr. Sigurdsson, I know you have a lot of staff over there. That was sarcasm. Yeah. Mr. Sigurdsson, to the question.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, in terms of the board, there wouldn't be an audit, I suppose, of or there wouldn't be a reason to look at the information. It's an automated process. It will be automatically transferred from the particular committee that's entering the PCR contribution into the file. Perhaps the Department of Revenue will have a process for examining those records, but there wouldn't be any individual on staff who would be going through those records on an individual basis. It's strictly automated.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. I will also say that one of the points of making sure that we limit the amount of data that is transferred from one agency or another is precisely to make sure that what you're suggesting is those safeguards are in place, right? We don't want to be providing additional information that isn't necessary to actually get the job done. So that we did address that in the A1. And I will say that data management practices and how often an agency or company reviews their data management practices can vary from agency to agency. Certainly, we expect and we require or ask for folks to do that on a regular basis, to continually be thinking about not only who has access to any data, but how that data is used and when or how it might be shared. Those are standard practices across the industry. And that is pretty common within any area where data is found.
Representative Scott, was this to this point?
Yeah, but I think.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Boehner. That's the point. We don't know who's looking at it, and we've had leaks in the past. That's why we, over the last few years, Representative Scott and others have been insisting in some of these things, putting in that stuff to have that audit trail to see who's looking at it in case there is leaks.
I think the point's been made. Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I'll just try to ask the question a different way. So in the case of a data breach at the Campaign Finance Board, do you have the ability, would you have the ability with, I know you have some new electronic systems over there, would you have the ability to track where that breach came from?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the board's IT operations are being moved to the Azure cloud, which is operated by Minit, and that includes several layers of security, including monitoring who has access to the records and where the records are coming from. To the extent, I suppose, if there was an audit, it could be used to track down who had access to any particular database, again, through the tools that are available through Minit.
Mr. Sigurdsson, I assume your staff have to log in to the system?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And, of course, we have a staff of 8, so it would be a relatively small audience that or group of people we would be discussing.
Got it. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Glad to continue the conversation with the bill's author if she thinks more needs to be done on this, and just to tighten it up, but thank you.
All right. With that, closing comments, Representative Bonner.
I think this is a great bill to really modernize our PCR system and encourage more folks to use it, so I would anxiously await your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to re-refer House Bill 4728 as amended to the Taxes Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Last but not least, Representative Hassan. I will move to re-refer House File 4746 to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. I know we do have several testifiers as well, but Chair Hassan, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin, and good morning to members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to hear House File 4746, which is establishing protection and better pay for drivers in the rideshare world. Here we go again. I came before you last year with this bill, trying to do the same thing, and our bill didn't make it to the finish line. But the silver lining about that incident is that the governor created a task force to look at, you know, how can all stakeholders give feedback on the well-being of the drivers, and how can we establish a study that looks at the pay. And this study that came out about a few weeks ago agrees with what the drivers have been telling us, that they don't get paid enough. They don't even get paid at the minimum wage in this state. And I first want to thank all the task force members. They have spent all their summer and part of their fall trying to figure out and strike a balance on this issue. I also want to thank the commissioner for DLI, who has done a tremendous work on this. It's my understanding that we're limiting the conversation on the provisions that attain to this committee, which are the private right of action and arbitration. And they are in sections 6, 7, and 9 on the bill. One may argue that there are existing statutes in place already, so why are we bothering, you know, doubling and down on this? Last year we heard from, and today we were probably going to hear from people who have been hurt while they're driving Uber and Lyft, people who have lost their loved ones, and the, you know, statutes in place and the laws that we have couldn't protect them. So the reason why this is important to these drivers and why we're pushing it forward is to make sure that if the existing laws didn't protect, this one's will. And it's very critical that when you show up for your work, that you go home safe to your family. I know that it's important to all of us. And none of us will show up here today if we knew that we're not going to make it home tonight to see our families. This is a really hard job because you are driving a car, you have your back to somebody, stranger in your car, you can't see what they're doing, and yes, there are some protections in place, but not enough. So that's why we're here in front of you today, and we have members of the community who are going to talk about why these two specific pieces are important and why we're moving forward with it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. First up, I have Stephen Cooper, and then I have Mr. Ali on deck.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much for hearing from me. Just
welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Stephen Cooper. I'm an attorney. I've been working with on this statute since its inception prior to the previous legislative session. I assume I'm just to focus my attention on the three portions that were mentioned, so that's what
yes,
I will do.
Yes, please.
First, on the private right of action and enforcement, that has a couple provisions to it. The most important part is the only way that a law makes any difference is if you can enforce it. And the private right of action is very simple. It's very much smaller than the one you passed last year. It is right to the point, and it allows a private right of action to be brought. The next section on that, which is part of that, is that a TNC cannot retaliate against drivers because they supported this bill or because they talked about this bill or things of that nature, and that's in there as well. All of this is on page, I think, 15 of the bill. The next part is discrimination is prohibited, and a lot of people will ask, well, why doesn't the State Human Rights Act apply? And the reason it doesn't is because the TNCs take the point of view that they're independent contractors. Independent contractors in almost all provisions are not protected by the Minnesota Human Rights Act. There's a couple of exceptions, but they would not apply to this. So this is merely to let the same mechanism, if you, and we've had a lot of situations where racism, disabilityism, and sexism have motivated decisions. So this will allow, if in fact the person can prove that, they still have to prove it, if in fact they can prove that, they can go to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights rather than the court to resolve that. And that's the quickest and fastest way. As far as forced arbitration not being required, forced arbitration's been a disaster in other communities. I'll use Seattle as an example. And in Seattle, when forced arbitration has been used, the backup is a couple of years. And what you have is it's a very slow and ineffective process. So what we have here is the basic, simple way to make this statute enforceable. It, apart from what I mentioned, it really doesn't wander into anything else. It's just the portion of the statute that makes it enforceable.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Mr. Ali. And then on deck, I have Joel Carlson. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eid Ali. I am the president of Minnesota Uber and Lyft Drivers Association, also known as MULDA. It has been a journey for the last 2 years to just kind of fight for this cause, and I myself was a driver. And we did all the best we could to make sure that we just raised our voice. And I think this is an opportunity for all of us on behalf of the drivers that we are bringing this issue in front of you. And we hope that you just voted in favor of it and pass it today so that we will have a win back with us home, because these drivers have been suffering for the last 10, 11 years. And today that we just get this opportunity to perform this issue in front of you, we expect each and every one of you to just support it and pass it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Joel Carlson, and I have John Reich on deck. If I tell you you're on deck, if you could move closer to the table, that would be great. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of Uber Technologies, a company that I've represented since they first started operations in Minnesota over 11 years ago. And in the last 18 months, we have spent countless hours trying to resolve the issues that are before you. And as Representative Hassan mentioned, the governor appointed a task force. That's how I spent my summer vacation. That task force came up with 24 consensus negotiated recommendations. Uber supports all 24 of them. And I want to commend the House, actually. They actively participated in that task force. The Senate, not so much.
Can't speak for them, Mr. Carlson.
The reason I bring that up, Madam Chair, as much as I'm House trained and like to disappoint our counterparts, is that some of the things that are reflected in this bill that are not consensus items, reflect drafting that really was not part of that consensus report. And I'm going to talk about two of them. The issue of a private right of action was offered at the task force. It was offered as a recommendation. It's in your big, thick packet on the very end on page 24. And it was rejected as a negotiated issue that is not how we're going to, for the first time, allow a private right of action to enforce a independent contractor situation. And these drivers are independent contractors. They pick when they want to work. They have a contract with the company. They pick how often, when, and if they don't want to work at all. That is the independent nature of their work, and we support that. But we didn't include this private right of action that we don't have for any independent contractors in the state of Minnesota. We don't want to treat this company any differently than any others. We also have concerns about the prohibition on arbitration. which also conflicts with Minnesota law. We have auto accidents that require, under 65B, the same law that we're talking about that requires arbitration to arbitrate those disputes, and now we say we can't. We don't know how that actually works. I think the House is working in good faith to get a bill done, and we are fully cooperative with that effort. We're not quite there yet, and these two provisions are not consensus, and we don't support them, and hopefully they will, at the right time, not be part of this bill because they don't belong here. Happy to answer questions, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. We'll move on to John Wright. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I hope that was a quick enough transition between testifiers.
Good job.
Thank you so much. My name is John Reich with Cozumel County Public Strategies, and we represent Lyft in Minnesota. Many of my comments are consistent with those of Mr. Carlson. We have we take pause or have issues with Section 6 and 9 of the bill for the reasons he mentioned. But I also want to mention that I spent my summer and fall and some part of the spring at the same task force as Mr. Carlson did. And it was, I think, yielded a great result. 24 recommendations were consensus recommendations, and legislation that is built on those is something we can support. I think we want to support legislation at the end of the day that's good for drivers and good for riders. And there was a lot of good give and take in those meetings, as Mr. Carlson mentioned. I'd like to commend Representative Hassan for her work on this issue. We think we can get there. As Mr. Carlson mentioned, we're not quite there yet, but look forward to continuing to work with the author and happy to take any questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any.
Madam Chair, there's somebody who wants to.
Oh, yep, yep. Come on up. Yep, and if there are two of you, if you both want to come up, if you're planning to testify. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed, and then we'll just let you know you have 2 minutes.
Okay. My name is Mohammed Igal. I am president of MULDA members organization. I think the biggest driver advocacy group in metro area. And I'm here to testify to tell you that if the drivers are voiceless, or they don't read, or they don't know specifically the clauses of the bill, you guys are their voice. So anyone who doesn't have an insurance, by default, government becomes their default insurer. So make sure that there are no loopholes, no hidden lines. If there are anything such loopholes or something that's not clear for the drivers, it's your responsibility, representatives. So we hope that insurance is the most important thing. No one should be left behind. No color should be hidden. So I just want to make sure. So my friend, Mahmoud, has the same case. He was injured. And he wanted to testify for himself, and nobody listened to him. He didn't get his rights, so he will testify this case. So it's
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record, and then proceed. And then you'll also have 2 minutes.
Good morning, members. My name is Mohammed Hamoud. I'm here to bring your attention to a matter of significant concern regarding the safety and well-being of rideshare drivers, but particularly a horrific and traumatic incident that I experienced while working as an Uber driver. On November 10, around 9 p.m., I got a ride request from a passenger. When I arrived at the pickup location, the passenger got into my car. As soon as I was about to leave toward his destination, several bullets were shot in my car. One of the bullets hit me in the back. I started believing, and I drove my car toward a safe place, and I called 911. I was taken to the hospital, and luckily, the bullet couldn't be removed immediately. The bullet would start in my chest for 3 months. This incident had big impact on me and put me into a state of deep physical pain and psychological trauma. I've been a lot of pain and feel scared, My goal was to provide a safe and comfortable ride for every passenger. But after I made this incident, I remain in a state of ongoing discomfort and stress. As injury sustained, have not fully healed, resulting in persistent chest pain whenever I move my arm. Also, I was unable to receive any financial assistance from Uber, leaving me an Opel to cover my medical expenses, school tuition, rent, and provide support for my family. Therefore, I'm here to pass this legislation that holds taxi companies to be accountable for their actions and ensures adequate support and protection for drivers who fall victim acts of violence while on duty. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Yeah. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. We do have a couple of pre-filed amendments, so we'll move on to those next. Representative Niska, I understand these are both your amendments, so if you want to move the A3 and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, yes, I do move the A3. Both of these amendments, really, as the testifiers referenced, are dealing with pieces of this that are outside of the 24 task force recommendations. I've heard from a lot of people, as I know you have over many months, Representative Hassan, who are concerned about what the implications of this are for Uber and Lyft in Minnesota. I think it would be good if, to the extent possible, that work towards those 24 points. But the A3 specifically is about the forced arbitration provision. As Mr. Carlson mentioned, it does conflict with other Minnesota law provisions, create some confusion around arbitration as it relates to car crashes. And it really, arbitration, I understand there might be some concerns in some certain circumstances, but it can be a good process for both parties involved. It's a matter of contract. But more fundamentally, I think that having this provision in there is really going to create a lot of confusion for drivers about what their rights are, whether they have to abide by the arbitration they've agreed to or not. And the biggest problem I think this has is that it conflicts with the Federal Arbitration Act, which applies to any contract involving interstate commerce and specifically preempts any provision like this in state law that would bar arbitration. There's Minnesota Supreme Court case directly on point on this, Johnson versus Piper Jaffrey, that deals with provisions in the Minnesota Human Rights Act that would overrule arbitration provisions. And the Federal Arbitration Act is going to control in every single one of these cases if a driver thinks that they don't have to abide by arbitration because of the statutory provision. They bring a case in court, Uber or Lyft or whoever the contract counterparty is going to move to compel arbitration, and they're going to win that under the Federal Arbitration Act. So I don't think that this is a provision that actually even does anything for drivers other than confuses them about what their rights are. So I think that this is not a good provision to have in the agreement for all of those reasons, and that's why I'm offering the A3 amendment.
All right, and I'll just remind the members of the public, if you cannot keep your phone silent, then you need to take your phone out of this room so that we can all hear each other as we do our work. Chair Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Niska, for this amendment. At this point, I will say I can't accept the amendment, but I'm willing to work with you offline. We have been working with the TNCs and all the stakeholders and in good faith, and we are willing to work with them. This bill is far from over. Like, it has another stop, and, I have meetings about this bill at least 3 or 4 times a week on my calendar. So I'm open to work with you offline, but I will not accept the amendment at this time. Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll move on to the vote. All those, Representative Niska renews his motion to adopt the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
All right. The motion does not prevail. Moving on to the A4.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hassan, this is, again, dealing with an issue that trying to narrow this to the 24 points in the task force recommendation. In particular, I think a general private right of action to enforce the provisions in this chapter isn't the appropriate way to deal with this issue for a couple of reasons. One is, as was referenced, every driver has a contract with the TNC, and they have a breach of contract already, a breach of contract right. They can bring a breach of contract claim against the TNC without this private civil right, civil action provision. What this private civil action provision would do is potentially bring all of these things about the entire policy issue, you know, whether what Uber's general policy is towards the state of Minnesota or what Lyft's general policy is towards the state of Minnesota into a bunch of different court cases potentially brought by a bunch of different people instead of having it be something that the commissioner enforces or the attorney general enforces. And so I don't think that's the right way to deal with, you know, things about the overall policy that Uber has or the overall policy that Lyft has. I think if one of those companies is it has policies that don't align with what our state policy is, then that's where I think it's the right person to enforce that is the commissioner or the attorney general. And of course, obviously, all of those things then will be incorporated into the contract right that each individual person has, and they can bring up that kind of a breach of contract claim. But I think that this, the way that this private civil action provision is written, it potentially creates more too much litigation or too many different potentially conflicting court cases. So I think that the better way to deal with it would be, again, in line with the recommendation. So that's the point of the A4 amendment.
All right. Chair Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, thank you, Rep. Niska, for the amendment. We are following the recommendations because this bill is based on the 24 recommendations that the task force made. The reason why we have this is two specific additions is that it's still important to the drivers, but we are working with the Attorney General's office, we're working with others, and I'm more than happy to work with you to figure out that there's still protection in place for these drivers and it's not creating chaos. So at this time, I will not accept the amendment, but I'm more than happy to talk to you offline.
All right. With that, we'll go ahead and take the vote. Representative Niska renews his motion to adopt the A4 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion does not prevail. Now we'll move on to member discussion of the underlying bill, specifically the provisions we've been focusing on under the jurisdiction of our committee. Representative Fickey.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and Representative Hassan, for your tireless work on this bill. I just had a question and then a comment. So my first question is, we've heard, you know, you participated in this task force, it seems like. Thank you for that. Thank you to everyone who did. We've heard about these 24 consensus items. Can you tell me, just like, when we say consensus, what do we mean? How did something arrive at consensus? Was it unanimous? Just to clarify.
Chair Hassan.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and Rep. Finke. So I didn't participate in the task force, but our majority leader participated on behalf of the House, and I don't believe the Senate participated. Well, I will tell you this. I was not present, but I think majority of the people were on board with what was going on. One of the things that I have maybe some concern about is that there are drivers that participated, but there was still some language barriers because when we talk about this bill, we're talking about, you know, legal language and legal terms that even if you speak English perfectly well, that it can be confusing. So there were consensus on majority of the people, and I see that Stephen Cooper raised his hand. Maybe he can talk about it. Nope.
Well, if we can keep it brief.
Very brief.
Were you part of the task force? No. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
President Mulder was part of the task force.
Yep.
But
yep.
Oh, okay.
If you could, yep. Chair, you wait till you sit down, and then I'll recognize you, and then you can start speaking. Yep. So, Mr. Cooper, and if you can just speak to specifically what we're talking about here.
I am. The only things that were in the 24 were unanimous decisions. Anything that there was even one person who disagreed with was kicked to the legislature. So what you needed is 100% had to agree with the thing. That's the only thing I wanted to say.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. And I just wanted to make sure that I understood that because I think it's important to the point that our testifiers made and to the point that the lobbyists made, right, which is that we had two full-time lobbyists who told us they worked in the summer, which I think most of us probably work in the summer, but not to put that down. But, I mean, there is this idea of driving consensus in a room with the people who are responsible for your employment. That is very suspect. What I think is so important for us to recognize here is that if they're doing their job, they're going to bring us recommendations that are going to benefit everyone. If we are doing our job, we are going to make sure our law recognizes the incredible power imbalance between massive corporate entities and their lobbyists versus individual drivers who are trying to make a living and, frankly, do not necessarily know everything that we are doing. So the idea that we would get rid of a private right of action or an arbitration process would so tilt the power imbalance towards what we call consensus, but what is really a legal framework that is meant to keep people out of the process. So I want to just really thank you for fighting to keep these pieces in. I think our job is not to do what this task force says and nothing else. Our job is to look at the task force and then make sure we're doing everything to protect our community members. So thank you so much for your work.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, thank you so much, Representative Hassan, to all your work on this and to all the testifiers. Really appreciate you being here today. I did hear something that Mr. Cooper said that that TNC drivers were not subject to the Human Rights Act. And I might have misunderstood that, but I just wanted to make it clear that under your bill, starting on line 15.16, they would be subject to the Human Rights Act and those protections. So I just wanted to make that point for the record. And again, I might have misunderstood something. Just wanted to make sure that that's clear on the record. That's all. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mueller. And I think I'm guessing what they meant is, like, generally they wouldn't be but for the language here. But I think that's a good catch to clarify that we are referencing back to the Human Rights Act statute as well. Further discussion to the bill. All right. Closing comments. Chair Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the discussion. This bill is about just fair wages, protections for people who don't have voices. Our job as elected officials and the state leaders of Minnesota is to make sure that we give voice when their voice is taken away. So I feel like these drivers' voices have been taken away because the scales are not balanced. I used to work in housing, and I used to attend housing court. And if you really want to see scales that are unbalanced, this bill reminds me of housing court because you have landlords who bring expensive lawyers, and then you have a family who's terrified in the idea of being evicted and in this traumatic stage that they have no idea how to act and what to do. And the process starts, and before you know it, an eviction is completed, and these people didn't even understand a word that came out of the judge's mouth or the lawyers. Go home to process that. I feel like this is the same story where you have the TNCs who have expensive lawyers at their disposal, and you have drivers who are working 16, 18 hours just to feed their family. And I want to put a myth out there that people think that when they think about Uber and Lyft drivers, they think it's a student that's doing this as a gig worker or somebody who has a full-time job who's doing this after work to just, you know, earn some money to build a deck or something. No, these drivers work 16, 18, 12 hours because that's their livelihood. And we're talking about thousands of drivers who, like, if they get injured today, they will not have anybody or any sort of protection. And what would happen is that they will be lying in the hospital. We as a state are liable to pay for their medical expenses. And while they are sick and can't work, we as a state are liable to feed their families. So I really think that there is a way to do this. And we have been working tirelessly with the TNC companies, with the drivers, with all the stakeholders, with the governor's office, the other body, to make sure that we pass something that protects drivers first and foremost, but also works for the TNC. And these drivers do not want Uber and Lyft to leave the state. Because they love their jobs, they enjoy doing this work, and I'm sure the TNCs do not want to leave either. So there is a balance we can strike here, and it's, first of all, we continue the legacy of Minnesota and the history of Minnesota of protecting workers, and we put in place a legislation that protects workers and, you know, guarantees them fair pay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Chair Hassan, for well over a year of work on multiple versions of this legislation. So we do appreciate it. With no further discussion, I will renew my motion to refer House File 4746 to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. All right, that wraps up our agenda. Thank you, members, for a good discussion today. And with that, we are adjourned.